Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. First, a shout out to everyone who's listening and a reminder, tell your friends, your enemies, family, all that kind of thing, and rate and subscribe and review and all the podcast jargon I'm supposed to say. And if there is reviews or there's things you want to see more of or less of, please let me know. I'm always open to suggestion. You can hit me up on Twitter at mcause56. And I wanted to do a bit of a cold open because the interview you're going to hear is with wine journalist Rick Van Sickle, second time on the podcast, first time live. Last time it was Zoom, it was during COVID. And we chat about the LCBO and how they're really not doing nearly enough to promote the wines of Niagara, Prince Edward County, really all across Ontario. I mean, the O in LCBO is Ontario. And during the interview, he was quoting some statistics and he told me that he got one wrong. And this is all about how the LCBO includes VQA wines, which VQA are wines that are made in Ontario from 100% Ontario grapes, and that the LCBO includes that those wines with the international domestic blend wines. And for anyone who doesn't know, those are wines made from 75% grapes from not in Ontario. Now, there has to be a minimum of 25% Ontario grape content, but the rest of the grapes can come from anywhere. So it's really not a true expression of the terroir of this province. And the issue is that there are so many of these international domestic blends and really not enough VQA wines getting represented, which again, of course, VQA, 100% Ontario wines. And the issue is that when the LCBO, when they state how much Ontario wines they are selling, they're like, look, we are local. This is Ontario. We're all about local wines and local farmers. Well, they include the VQA and the international domestic blend sort of together. And so, you know what? I'll just read these stats from Rick, because really the issue here is the LCBO isn't maybe giving you a completely honest assessment of how much Ontario is being represented at your local LCBO. So I'm going to read Rick's statistics. And again, I know I might be just getting a lot of information at you, but it's important because Rick is a real journalist, unlike me, and he's all about accuracy. So the VQA has roughly 7% market share in the LCBO. And the LCBO continues to report these international domestic wines in their Ontario wines and shows a market share of 30%. So in reality, the domestic blends, that's a 23% market share, or three times more the 100% Ontario wines, which is only 7% of the market share in the LCBO. 7% of all the inventory are wines from 100% Ontario grapes. That's ridiculous. And again, to quote Rick Hare, still embarrassing, but not the 34% I quoted. Sorry, I should have been more careful. So 34% versus 30%. And Rick just wanted to make sure I got that out for everyone out there, that correction. I hope I explained it. And if I didn't, my apologies, but you're going to love this interview with Rick Van Sickle.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. It is my second time with Rick Van Sickle, the man behind winesinniagara.com, a must website for anyone who's interested learning more or just wants to keep up with all things wines in Niagara. I'm in his home. He's opened up a delicious Niagara Riesling. Rick, first cheers. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for coming to Niagara. I'm looking forward to a second go with you. This is great. Pleasant surprise.
Let's start in a very different place. Instead of big picture, what are we drinking?
This is a Daubin Estates Riesling made by, you know, the super duo of Peter Gamble and Sperling. For a little 20-mile bench property that has a great history. And they're really concentrating on only a few wines, but done in a super micro, all made in a super micro way. You know, this will be three picks from 1 ton per acre, a little bit of botrytis, so you get that beautiful, just beautiful, you know, tertiary notes that you get from botrytis. You know, it's expensive. It's like $60 for a bottle of Riesling. That's pricey in Niagara. Wait till this thing grows up.
It's rich. It's honeyed. When I smelt it, I was getting first the fruit, and then a beat later came in the smokiness and the slate and all the other notes you'd expect from sort of high-end Riesling. They were all sort of there. And you know what's annoying is that I've done a whole bunch of interviews recently over the last couple of days, and I was editing them, and I realized I'm so damn positive. Like, all the wines are really good. Like the Henry Appel and Bordeaux blends, the Kirby Estate Merlots and the Chardonnay and everything about Westcott. Part of me feels like I need to have some edge. I need to, you know, shit talk some of these wines and say, this is crap. But I've just been on a heater of really impressive wines all throughout Niagara.
When we look at market share, has not increased at the LCBO for Ontario wines forever. Stuck at 7% market share. And I don't know why, because the wines... Like when I first got into wine, started writing about wine in Canada, I didn't even taste local wines from and I was in Calgary at the time, in BC or Ontario. I just never drank them. They just weren't worth drinking. That was, I don't know, 24 years ago, 25 years ago.
Yep.
They are just at the best they've ever been, I get, which of course makes perfect sense. People know their vines better, their winemakers are better, they're sourcing grapes from the right spots, better clones, you know, a lot of factors, but they just keep rising in quality. I don't understand why it's stuck in a bit of a hole, especially at the LCBO. It boggles my mind.
Yeah, me as well. And I'm going to do my best not to repeat things I've said with other winemakers. I do. My source for optimism would be maybe the next generation of wine drinkers don't have the same historic connection with the old world, maybe more focused on shopping local. And if you care about the environment, there's less carbon footprint, because none of these wines are flights and planes and trucks, you know, getting from somewhere in Bordeaux to Summerhill.
Yeah, it's all of that you know, wine drinking consumption is way down, as you know, the statistics are there.
Yeah.
People have moved off wine dramatically. The no alcohol wines have increased dramatically. And yeah, we have a problem with youth getting into classic wines, I think. You know, like the, okay, I don't want a Riesling, I don't want a Cab Franc, do I want a Pinot, do I want a Chardonnay? No, give me something that I've heard about, that's got a great story.
Super funky.
I just found it. Yeah. Somebody's tipped me off to it. You know, when all the great wines are not, I mean, they're in all different places, but you can't miss out on the classic wines that are being made at a high end.
I know everyone wants to find that cool garage band that no one's ever heard of before. And those bands are good, but there's a reason why the White Album sold a lot of copies. It's the same reason why Chardonnay sells so much Chardonnay.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, when I was young and getting into wine, you know, I was chasing, I think I may have said this 2 years ago, but chasing Parker Wines. Sorry, but that's what was out there.
But it's the influence. And we all get influenced by the major writers. And to some extent, it's not a problem. Like, you know, if Jancis Robinson really likes a wine, I'll probably give it a little bit more the benefit of the doubt. And everyone got under the spell of Robert Parker, who actually someone let's talk about him, because you're a wine journalist for ages. I think the problem is that when he really pushed his one style, it's not that he liked it. It's that people changed the way they made their wines to fit him. So let's add more alcohol and body, because economically that's going to work, even if it goes against our philosophy or the terroir.
Yeah, but you know, is that his fault? Or I don't know if it's his fault.
Yeah, chicken and egg.
He liked those wines. Winemakers, why would you? I guess you're chasing points and whatnot. It was a big thing back then. I don't think it is so much anymore.
I think it's much less so.
And people's palates changed. You know, they got away from Parker. But in those beginning, you know, in the beginning, things like Gewurztraminer, you know, from Alsace and, you know, these offbeat, those were the kind of things that, you know, my young palate really loved. And really, you know, that's the old version of what they're doing today. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody was drinking Alsace in Ontario. Like, it was crazy.
Yeah.
No. My wife and I were like guzzling it. Yeah.
You probably got it at a good price back then. Getting back to Ontario and, you know, just the quality level. I remember in the early 2000s, I remember when I was getting into wine, every time, you know, and maybe just bad luck, every time I would try Canadian wine, especially Canadian red, I didn't like it. I'm like, this is gross. I don't want to have this anymore. And it really wasn't only until maybe a little over, it was a little over a decade ago. And then it just started with, you know, Chardonnay and like Pinot from, you know, and Pinot Noir. And really only the last 7 or 8 years where I'm game for almost any of the classic varietals because there's a place in Ontario that's going to make it well.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I've tasted now, I didn't taste them back then, but many of the older wines, like from the 80s and 90s, and they are still standing the test of time. Some of them, you know, the Chateau de Charmes and the whoever was around, Inniskillen, and you know, the old wineries that were around way back then, were making incredible reds from Bordeaux grapes that I suspect were undrinkable back then, but have stood the test of time and have aged like a great Bordeaux into these beautiful wines. Like I can, Matt, I can go downstairs and pull you out a 30 bench 1998 that I was sitting there. I tried its sister wine not too long ago. It's mind blowing.
Really?
How good it is. 98, just fantastic. And you know, we don't think about the Bordeaux varieties, especially Cab Sauv, ripening. And Cab Sauv does have some struggles.
Yes, it does.
But you still have Merlot and Cab Franc, which do fantastic here. And they're still making decent blends out of them.
I brought up the story when I was speaking with Dan Speck, a little dinner I was at, an 02 of his Cab Merlot stood up against an 02 Latour. Now, the Latour still scored higher, but it also cost about $800 more. So, I mean, that was my example of just older Bordeaux varietal Ontario that did really well. There's one thing that I think people that if they read your work, they know is that, you know, you put in a lot of time and attention when it comes to assessing the vintage. So let's go to the most recent one. The 2023 vintage felt like it started bad, ended strong. What are your thoughts on what this, what the harvest was from last year?
I will say this. I'm going to publish, my harvest report is published live tomorrow. It was supposed to be Tuesday, but.
Perfect. So when this is released, you've got a couple of weeks, so you're not going to be stepping on anything.
Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah. So in my harvest report, which is derived from, you know, 20 or 30 growers and winemakers themselves, and then I make, you know, some comment at the beginning of it, and then I let them tell it like it was for them. To put it simply, it was a great spring, nice and warm, horrible summer, and then fall magically came along, dried everything up and became warm, gave a long, leisurely growing season at the end that really saved it. So I would call it mostly a classic vintage. In other words, not over jammy reds, finessed reds, good cellaring potential. The whites are, you know, they could let things hang as long as they want, which is always a good thing when you have that, when you're allowed to not be rushed to pick everything, when it's still warm, deep into fall, that's good for the grapes. Now, it was a wet, you know, there was smoke haze from BC. It had everything.
I mean,
it was
right. Actually, I'd like to hear more about your process. You know, but going over the harvest. So you were saying you speak with 20, 25, is it the winemakers, is the winery owners? I'd love to hear a little bit more, Rick, about how you just your information gathering and just coming up with your final conclusions.
When I started doing the harvest report, it was...
What year?
10 years ago.
Okay.
In earnest, like making it an annual thing. I had always been out there during harvest visiting winemakers, out there watching them bring in the grapes, watching them crush the grapes, tasting barrel samples over time. And they just out and out did not tell the full truth, I would say. And it was terrible, right? I'm putting this BS, can I say that, on my blog, you know, on my website. It wasn't good. And so I went back to them, I said, look, you got to be, it can't be the vintage of a lifetime every year.
Yeah.
Like it can't be. Everybody knows you're BSing us. You got to tell it like it is. And slowly they did. And now I know the ones who don't. And it's wonderful. They will tell an accurate, truthful story about the vintage and I can get a better assessment. And And most of them are spot on, you know, with how they're going to turn out. I mean, it's not a good thing to say, God, it's a 10 out of a 10 vintage. I mean, it's spectacular. When it rained all fall, you know, I was there. I know what happened. You know, you can't say that.
Were those awkward conversations back in the day, going to some of these individuals and leveling with them?
Absolutely, it was awkward. You know, even now, if they submit one, and I find something that's totally off, I will go back to them, because I can't. Like, it's not. It's about ethics. You know, you have to be truthful, and they get it. They all get it. Some are a little. Some are really, you know, involved and keep notes for this harvest report. And some just have a succinct,
yeah,
an assessment of what did well and what didn't. All of it's important information.
How much is the connection between honesty and your relationships with them? Like, have there some wine owners or winemakers where you can see over the years they've become more honest and transparent with you just because you guys have developed a relationship of trust and understanding?
I think that's true. It takes a long time to gain trust both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some out there who would rather not talk to me, and that's fine. But the ones that I've talked to over the years, it's been a great relationship. And I think we're honest with each other. I think that's the key.
What were you doing 1 month before you did your first blog entry, before your first Rick Van Sickle web presence talking all things Niagara wine? What was life like for you before you started?
Before I was a wine writer?
Yeah. It's sort of like a long one, just a different way of asking the genesis behind you got into winesandniagara.com.
I guess it's a funny story, but maybe not to others. I've been a lifelong journalist, mm-hmm, as I think you know.
Yep.
And an editor mainly. And I took a job where I was transferred from Ottawa, where I was the editor-in-chief, to Calgary, where I took a job as a Sunday editor. I was into wine at that point, you know, trying wines. I had a pretty good cellar going. Loved wines. I could already write, because I'd been writing my whole life, so writing wasn't a problem. Writing a wine column might have been. So I fired the wine writer I inherited, and she agreed. I mean, it wasn't good. Like, it just was not a good. It was geographical.
You know? Right.
I went to Spain and ate some great food. Oh, I had a couple of wines. Didn't help anybody in
right
Calgary. I said to myself, well, I'll just do it so we don't miss a beat on having a weekly wine call. I had no intention of finding anybody else. I hired myself to do it. And I was terrible. I was just awful. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, but I got to know people. I started going to more local tastings. I went to my first Canadian trip to the Okanagan, just over the mountains. Started bringing Canadian wines into the picture, and it took off from there. I never stopped writing a column after that.
First, would you ever be nervous to read your early writings? Like, the same, yes, way I wouldn't want to listen to my first broadcast on TSN radio like 12 years ago.
Absolutely. Because they don't get edited, right?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to edit the wine column. They don't understand it anyway.
And yeah, and you know, then they would look at the word Gewürztraminer and like, is that a real word? Then the other, by the way, I get laughed at all the time. I mispronounce 70% of all hockey names.
Yeah.
And then everyone's like, wait a minute, you can pronounce Gewürztraminer. But anyway, the other question, when you got started, did you realize just how much your identity was eventually going to be about the region of Niagara?
No, I didn't know if I was going back to Niagara.
Mm-hmm.
I was eventually transferred back to the Toronto Sun, where I started, and carried the column with me. By then the column was syndicated, and I just wrote it out of Toronto at that point, and carried it over to, you know, after I left Sun Media, I came here, wrote the column here at the, where are we? St. Catharines,
yeah.
And, you know, and then that's where I started putting it. You know, eventually I said, this is ridiculous. I don't want to freelance anymore. I don't want people owning my stuff anymore. I want to own it myself. So that's why I built the website. It was unmonetized, no ads. I was doing it for fun. I still am, But now there is some monetization, because I don't think, I think everybody should get paid. If you're writing about a winery, a winery's wine, somewhere along the line, you know, there has to be, you can't do it for free. Like, you know, one rule in journalism, whenever I talk to a journalist at school or whatever, one thing I said to them, never take a job where they don't pay you. Never do it. Like, you don't do things, don't do it for free. It's not.
If we had more time, we'd go through all things about internships and stuff, but and the morality of that, but we don't have time. We should also tell people right now that what is about to happen in the next 30 to 40 seconds on this podcast, Rick.
My dog Maisie is going to go crazy because her one and only real true love, mm-hmm. my wife,
yep.
Maureen, coming through that door
yep.
after a hard day's work.
Mm-hmm. Oh no, and I think my shoes are in the way. I don't want her, oh, she's going to trip on it. Oh, I feel so bad. My shoes are in the way. We'll pause Wait, where's the barking? There's no barking. We'll pause for a quick moment. And we are back. You were mentioning about your website, non-monetized. What is your philosophy in terms of advertising when it comes to the site?
It's a great question because it's such a muddled world right now, as you know.
Yeah.
What does monetized mean? Do I do promotions? Like, no, I don't do any of that. Do I pay for play on? Do I write reviews for? No, none of that. It's really, the only thing I know is newspapers. So I set it up like a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
You advertise, let's say your Pilateri's an advertiser, and has been for a long time. It doesn't mean that, Pilateri's getting preferential treatment. What I'm trying to provide is an environment where people will see your ad, click it, mm-hmm. and hopefully visit or buy something.
Right.
Now that's what advertising is. It's not, everybody can see through a paid for ad and I don't do that. I've never done that. I fought against it when I was an editor with advertorials and made sure that they were, separate state and church. You can't use the same fonts as the story across from you, the same headlines.
Right.
And that's how I operate as a website, like a newspaper.
How is the state of wine journalism right now?
Oh, I hope we're running out of time.
We are not.
Okay.
We are not. And I know it's a difficult question. And you know, there's good and bad. There's the positive impact of influencers. There's the negative impact of it. But you know, I mean, it's funny having you on. I actually kind of wanted to turn a little bit of this into a journalism conversation.
Well, yeah, it's complicated, right? I mean, there are influencers. Do they call themselves influencers?
I don't know. You know what?
Content providers.
Now I feel old. I'm sure it's moved on to a new title or definition, and I'm just behind the times as a 48-year-old.
Yeah. Well, imagine me then.
Yeah.
I follow a lot of them. I don't understand who got paid to do what. That's my concern. You're writing, you're putting something out there. You mm-hmm. love this wine. You're doing Instagrams, a lot of them. Did you get paid? I think people need to know that.
Right, yeah.
And they need to figure out how to do it. Like paid promotion, whatever it is, because it's not there right now.
Well, that transparency, I think, is important. It's the same thing with any version of media, whether you're covering sports, news, politics, economics, entertainment. Is transparency, I think, is important for the reader so that they trust who they're reading.
Yeah. Well, you're doing a disservice to both the winery who paid you and the people who follow you
mm-hmm.
if you're not upfront about it. I mean, otherwise, like all wine is silly then. At that point, it's just,
yeah.
It's silly. You've got somebody paid to say great things about this particular wine, and you've got people writing about it who aren't paid and writing about it in a serious way. I don't know, how does anybody reckon with that?
Yeah, no, you're right. That's tough. For me, because I'm not a journalist with a capital J. I'm just an incredible enthusiast with a WSET diploma background. My rule is on my Instagram, I will always say someone sent me a wine. But my rule is, if I tell the people ahead of time, if I like the wine, I'll review it. If I don't like the wine, I'm just not going to talk about it. I'm not going to promote it. I'm not going to put it up on Instagram and say, this is crap. I remember once getting like six bottles from a consignment company. And the most expensive bottle was a California Cab. It was like $85, $90. I thought it was horrible. And my girlfriend's like, she just felt guilty because she's nicer than me. She's like, aren't you going to say anything and or like promote it? I'm like, no, it's not good wine. And so that's sort of my philosophy. But again, you know, if we did a journalistic tree, you are far higher up on the branch than I am. So that's my basic philosophy and my little niche of the Instagram social media world.
That's totally the right way to do it, in my opinion. And it's essentially what I do. I don't solicit for wine samples. I will accept them. I will taste your wines, and I'll only write about them if they reach a certain threshold that both I think the readers of my website would appreciate and you would appreciate that it didn't get mentioned if it was, you know, below that threshold. That's the deal I make, I guess. You know, I cap it off at nothing under 87 points now. It used to be 85.
Right.
Probably lower at some other point. And, you know, 87, it's got to be, you know, pretty good value. You know, I'm not giving that, you know, 87 point wine 97 points because it represents good value. I think it should be just considered in the same sphere as the other wines with a notation, a good value wine. You know, a great Riesling at $13. Love it. You know, just a thirst quencher. Fantastic. I get excited by that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are wineries here that are making, you know, great wines at $20 and under who don't get a lot of love. And they should, because they're making good wines at a great price.
Yeah, I tried Dan Speck's Family Tree Cab Merlot. And it was like $17.95. I'm like, all right. It tastes what a Bordeaux varietal made in Canada would taste like. And I'm like, this is an enjoyable wine. This is a fantastic Wednesday wine. Moving off journalism, but more on the news. I'm curious your thoughts about this. Just Doug Ford and the changes with alcohol in Ontario, how it'll be retailed, elimination of the 6.1 basic wine tax at on-site VQA wine and retail stores, enhancement of the VQA wine support programs beginning at some point this year. There's been some news, and I wasn't sure, or I was curious your opinion on how much of an impact you think that would have for the Ontario wine industry.
Well, let's start with the 6.1% tax. That's a crazy tax to begin with. It's only on VQA wines. VQA wines coming into the LCB were charged that for no imports. Just VQA wine.
Why was that? Where did that come from? What's the motivation behind that?
No idea. But what's up with that? The Ontario wines are the most taxed in anywhere, any other wine region in the world at 40%. BC's at 31%. The US is 8%.
That's insane. What I'm curious about is, where did that philosophy first come from? And I'm not asking for answers, but that's insane, because 40% is a number. But the story or the context behind it is the United States is 8, and even BC, that you think, okay, it's Canada, they're going to tax high in BC, you know, more left-leaning place, it's 31%. That's insane that the winemakers here have been hampered like that for so long.
I know, it's absolutely insane. And all of the things that you mentioned there, the 6.1%, that tax had to go. There's other, you know, there's little bits and bobs that they promised to do. The most important one to me, and I think to a lot of people in Niagara and the industry, is the LCBO, like, starting to get that 7% market share number up. That's embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing for the LCBO. I don't know why they don't see it. When you consider, you know, what IDB wines are.
IDB, sorry?
IDB, International Domestic Blend.
Okay, yeah, yes, yeah.
I'll sell it in Canada.
Yeah.
So when you consider those wines, their market share is 32%. Ontario, 100%. Ontario is 7%.
That can't be that has to be some sort of unwritten rule going on at the LCBO. Like what the O in the LCBO is Ontario. Now I'm just frustrated. I don't even know if I'm more frustrated or confused. Frustrated because I have friends in the industry, and confused about why there is this the LCBO thinking that it's too difficult to sell Ontario wine, and that it's just easier, whether it's going to be an $80 Kirby Estate Merlot versus an $80 Washington State Merlot or a Wright Bank, that it's just easier to put to sell a Merlot at that price point if it comes from a more established country. I don't know why the LCBO would do this.
Well, if you use, just let's use the, you know, Scott Kirby and his wines. He makes, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000 cases. Not sure what he's at right now. Makes beautiful wine. He could submit his wine, but he cannot compete against the California Wine Institute and the amount of dollars they put into selling their members' wines.
Right.
Super rich association plopping money down in the LCBO's lap into their magazine, Food and Drink, into preferential shelving, into, you know, all the media we now see on social media propping up California wines. Scott Kirby, well, huh? And the, you know.
So does it just come down to the very simple thing, like anything in life, money? The LCBO doesn't make as much money. Ontario, all the wineries are small. Like most of them, like even the largest ones would be considered boutique in most other parts of the world. Is it just not enough supply, and other parts of the world will give more money to the LCBO?
The LCBO is not lifting a finger if you're not playing the marketing game with them. Mm-hmm. Dumping money into their coffers to have Ontario wines promoted, and Ontario does not have the money to match the EU. Mm-hmm. Or California or Chile or any of these big countries, with Australia trying to dump wines all over the world, and having, you know, Canada, the LCBO is a perfect place to do it. So they spent a lot of dollars giving the LCBO money to promote their wines.
So then it goes to this sort of philosophical question. What is the responsibility of the LCBO? Is it just to make money? And I'm not even trying to say that in a negative way. There's nothing wrong with making money. We all have rent, mortgages, and things like that. Is it strictly about making money, or is it about trying to elevate Canadian industry?
It's about strictly making money. In what Ford has said, the LCBO must try and find ways to promote Ontario wines. How that takes shape, nobody knows right now.
I would say the one thing that I can understand the difficulty for them is filling their shelves, because there isn't as much. We don't make as much wine as you can get thousands of cases of Rocca della Macy Chianti versus how much wine Batchelder makes per year. I wonder, because the easy thing for me to do, and I do it all the time, is to be very critical of the LCBO, and they deserve it. But then I wonder, is it partially because we don't have the supply in the vines here in Ontario?
We've got the supply to.
Yeah.
Well, we don't. You know, a winery like Kirby, I'm sorry, Scott, if you're out there, we're not picking on you or anything, but a winery like Kirby can supply the flagship stores. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the LCBO's mission is,
right,
here comes a new Ontario one. You got to get it into all 279 stores. Yeah, you know, we're not California. We can't do that. So you have to bend the rules. You have to make some rules that you have to, in my opinion, support the Ontario wine industry in some form or another.
Like
you know, the Christmas edition of Food and Wine, I think that's what they call the LCBO magazine, Food and Wine, there had to be 400 pages, 300 of them glossy, full-page ads promoting different wines, different regions. No, nothing from Ontario. Does that make sense to you? Like, can you do that as a Canadian company working for the people of Ontario?
Yeah. It's a taxpayer-funded thing. The LCBO is like, yeah, no, you're right.
We're paying for it. We're paying for your job.
And you know what? You said it best about just putting it in the flagship ones. I don't expect Pearl Morissette's high-end Cab Franc to be at the tiny Dunchurch LCBO that's a half an hour east from Parry Sound. But at Summerhill, in you know what, or in Oakville, or you want a small area where there's more money, say Port Carling, which is in the Lake Muskoka region, where there's certainly a lot of people with money, then you can sell a $58 bottle of Wismer Parkey Batchelder Pinot Noir. So you're right, it should be okay. You don't have enough supply for every LCBO to get 36 bottles, but we can put some in places where we know there's people that will spend money on wine.
Right. And do some promoting, Dan.
Yeah.
Like, be proud of your province. Like,
yeah.
Come on out here, George. Come out, head of LCBO, and tell the winemakers and wineries what they can do better to help you promote them. I mean, we're Canadians here. You know, and I know well, it's unfair. You know, we got to treat Australia like we treat Ontario, like we treat BC, like we
do. Is that what Australia does? Does Australia treat other countries equally the same?
Like, are you kidding? No
exactly.
One else does.
Yeah.
But is there another monopoly like the LCBO anywhere?
No.
There might be a crazy U.S. state or two.
Yeah.
And Quebec, of course.
Yeah, SAQ.
And a couple of provinces. Where, who cares? Like, we care because we have a wine industry here. You know, BC's doing a way better job at it. Just do like BC does. Let's just get a start somewhere. Now, they have VQA stores, which are great. We don't have those.
Moving from serious to more fun.
Okay.
That's what I like about having you on. We can bounce. By the way, I have so many questions here. I'm not even going to get to anywhere close to all of them. Quote from Rick Van Sickle, "I crave the human connection to wine rather than the antiseptic nature of tasting wines alone in my living room with a spittoon and a very needy dog vying for attention." You know what the funny thing is? I cut and pasted that sentence before I knew that there was going to be a needy dog that I am currently petting. Yes, you are a very good boy. Yeah, how different is that for you? Because it does speak to the emotional nature of wine, that it just, I don't know if it tastes better, but you get more joy when you're drinking it with maybe the people responsible.
Well, first and foremost for me is the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the tasting note, the scoring, you know, it's a pleasure drinking it. I don't mind taking notes. I have to sit there and write it. The pleasure for me is listening to a winemaker tell me how they made that wine.
Yeah.
You taste a wine with them and you go, wow, that's pretty interesting. What did you do here? And then you get an incredible story out of them. And then it becomes your story. So the story is first and foremost. If if I had a bunch of Niagara wine sitting on the table right now, ready to taste and take notes, I don't get any of that. I get none of it, right? The tech sheets are tech sheets. I know what the TA is. I know what the RS is.
Yeah.
I don't get the story. And they all have great stories. And especially their winemakers by nature are fun people. They're interesting, right? How they got there is interesting. And what they're doing in their little tiny plot of land is really interesting to me.
You're preaching the converted. I mean, my whole podcast is so much of it is autobiographical, and so many of the winemakers here, they do. They all have great stories. My favorite question to ask, especially an Anne Sperling, I'm like, Anne, when was the last time you went to the movies? And she'll laugh. I'm like, did you watch all of an entire season of Game of Thrones? Have you ever binged watched a TV show? And their eyes pop out. They're like, do you think I have time for something like that? Like, I love doing that, but you're right. It's great stories. Ooh, okay, here's a question I wrote down. What positive reviews get people more upset at you? I'm going to give you three options. You may only pick one, Rick. Which one, when you give a positive review, will that get more people going, what the hell are you talking about? Door number one, orange wine. Door number two, natural wine. Door number three, a Passamento-style wine. If you give a positive review, which one do people get the most upset about?
That is a tough question. What was number one?
Orange. Orange, natural, or a Passamento?
I think a Passamento is polarizing.
Mm-hmm.
It upsets people. You know who it upsets?
Mm.
Italians.
Yes.
It does. It's always the same. It's like, they can't do a Passamento in Ontario. You can only do that in, Verona.
Yep.
What? You can dry grapes anywhere, can't you? I mean, do you have like, there's a license that you can only, it's only in Italy? I mean, it's crazy to me. You know, and they're not commenting on the review per se. It's that somebody has the audacity to use dry grapes in a wine in Ontario. I don't know. That's weird to me.
It speaks to the conservative nature of a lot of winemakers, and often the conservative nature of wine itself, where if it wasn't done, it can only be done in this country and this way, and no other way shall do.
Well, that's nuts. Yeah. There'd be no wine anywhere in the world except for, where was it invented? Where was it first discovered? Rome?
Yeah.
I don't know. That would be it. It would stop there because everything would be a diversion of that.
And I mean, all sparkling would have to be done by monks, you know, somewhere in northern France.
Right.
And that'd be a shame because we do good sparkling here. So in your big article, the wines you were most excited about, you don't have to give all of them away, but one or two that just, you know, one white, one red that really excited you from the 2023 vintage.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I do pick the two that I picked as my red and white, and the Daubin Draw. No, now I can't remember. Yeah, this wine was the number one white. So
you opened the number one white you were most excited about. Thank you very much. It's a great wine.
Yeah, no, I did that on purpose because it's exciting to me. I love Riesling, and it's in such it's got problems right now. And
what does that mean? It has problems right now.
Well, people are shying away from it. Like so much Riesling. There was a grape surplus here in 2023, and so much more Riesling than any other variety was cut to the ground to rot. And people, you know, are saying they're going to pull out Riesling, and it's sad because it is a fantastic grape in Niagara. I mean, and when you get somebody, you know, Peter Gamble and Ann Sperling, keep mentioning them, get them involved and champion the grape like this, you have to applaud that. We have to save Riesling. People who love wines in Ontario have to love Riesling. How can you not love it? Now, it has an identity, as you've mentioned, an identity crisis. Nobody knows what they're getting. Is it? It's, you know, at the low level, it's overly sweet and it's not balanced and all that stuff. What's our style? What's dry? We don't know what we're getting.
Yeah. Like
you go to a LCBO and a normal person could walk out with a bottle of Riesling and open it and hate it because they thought either I thought it would be dry or B, I thought it would be sweet. There's nothing on the label. But at its finest here, it could compete in the world, I believe. You know, that and Chardonnay and Cab Franc, I think, are three that can compete on the world stage.
I worry about Riesling because this conversation we've been having for a decade, you know, and it's at least for me, you know, I got my WSET diploma in 2015, which is now almost a decade ago. And so, you know, before that, so many great wine writers, winemakers, wine owners, sommeliers, people who own restaurants, who manage vast wine programs, they all say the same thing. We love it. We wish more people bought it. We're doing our best. Man, everyone's been spreading the word for ages, but it still isn't being reflected in sales. It's a shame. It's like the point where I don't really have an answer, except I'll just be in my corner drinking it.
I know. It in fact, it's going down, obviously. We're right now ripping out Riesling vines in Niagara. Unheard of. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can grow, like, it's one thing that you can grow and it lasts forever. Like, you can't, it's hard to kill. The only problem it has is maybe some moisture in the fall, which creates some rot. That's the only, never, the vines go on forever and ever. It's easy to make. I was pleasantly surprised to read a young woman who, they started up a brand called Liebling Wines. Mm-hmm. It's owned by the children of the manager of and owner of Hubel Grapes. And she went on a rant about Riesling you know, saying, what is going on, people? Just a young woman, loves Riesling, doesn't understand what's happening with it, and did like a 5-part stories on her, on the Liebling Instagram. And that, I was happy about that. Here's a young, she's not a winemaker. She's a marketing, but her family owns lots of acres of grapes, and they started their own label. They make Riesling. And just, what are you doing, people? Like, but people, we need more young people to get involved and talk about Riesling and promote it. I don't even know if that's possible.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as I said, I spent.
You have to pay somebody. Can we get a Riesling?
I'll do it.
Champion. How much do you need?
I'll take the job. I spent my birthday last year at Marcus Molitor. You know, I'll certainly champion the grape. All right, then the other side, on the red side, one bottle, one producer, who the one of the most exciting wines of 2023 on the red side would be what, Rick Van Sickle?
Well, this is a controversial one, but the one I did choose as the most thrilling was the new Stratus white label red, a blend.
Why is that controversial?
$145 a bottle.
Mm. Did it deserve to be that price?
Yeah, I don't venture into the world of, I never have. Mm-hmm. I don't own a winery. I can't tell people not to charge. You know, to me, it's charge whatever you want. If people don't buy it, you're charging too much.
Yeah.
You have to drop your price. If you're way down here and you're not charging enough, well, that's good for everybody. Like, why should I be a critic of pricing? It's what's in the bottle that counts to me. I don't take, just like I don't add points for being a good value, I don't take away points for being a horrible investment.
Right. I got you.
I'm not saying this, I don't want Stratus to think it's not a good investment. I bought some. I think it's an incredible wine in Niagara that takes the Stratus top wine that used to be the red at, I think it's $48 now a bottle. So that's double,
yep.
More than double.
More that is more than double.
But I see the work that went into it.
Yeah,
the number of years that they plotted out what are the best blocks, and I know the whole story, and it's a good story. It comes from a good place. It comes from spending a lot of money to get there.
Mm-hmm.
They established the prices. You can judge by, you know, whether it's worth it or not. It's not my place to do that.
I never blink at the price of wine, even if it's, you know, if it's at 140, because I know the margins are slim. I don't get angry at spend. And again, I've said this in like, I feel like in every pod, I don't have children. I spend money on wine more than almost anything else. I get more angry when I buy popcorn at the movie theater, a small popcorn, and it's like $10, because I know that really only costs them 28 cents to make. That infuriates me. I never get upset about spending whatever I spend on wine, because I know in Ontario, they're not raking in tons of money, and the amount of time and money and oak and human labor and paying their workers well or a fair wage and hand picking and dropping tons of fruit and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's all there. I always wonder how, that's another part is, and this has been a theme for so long, is getting people to understand that if you're going to spend $80 on a Bordeaux blend from Saint-Emilion, then you should feel comfortable doing the same for the Stratus one, because they've put in their time and attention and money to make that one as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. You know, I don't, lots of people, I think personally, I think that there are a lot of wines out there that are overpriced. And if I review them, I review them in the same way I review every wine, but they're not going to be happy with a like an 88 for a, you know, $80 bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's, I would still do that. I mean, but I'm not going to say in the review, like, way overpriced. That's up to them.
By the way, what's the blend of that that Stratus? Because do you remember what the blend is of that Stratus? I'm curious about it, because they're crazy with their blends.
And it's like nine different red grapes.
Oh God, okay, never mind.
It's right. Like the Stratus red, just a combination of a bunch of grapes. I could look it up.
No, it's okay.
But the thing about it is sourced from tiny little plots within plots. So they did all this geo mapping, and they'll find one little spot that there's like 45 vines, and they'll pick those, go to the next block.
Wow.
And hand-picked, everyone.
Jesus.
Every single block hand-picked.
Okay, so they're going above and beyond for that wine.
Oh, it's so labor-intensive, it's unbelievable.
That's crazy. Okay, I got time for one more question. Okay. If I showed you all of this, by the way, one that you mentioned, shout out, great story, the Stonebridge Vineyard Sauvignon Blanc Reserve. That is a crazy wine.
Isn't it? That's unbelievable.
I've talked about it on my podcast before when I was interviewing the owner at Stonebridge and about how Peter saw this other vineyard where it was all decrepit and the winery owners or the vineyard owners said, sure, you can have those grapes, and you know, made this incredible wine. So I'm just going to read.
I want your thoughts on it though.
Oh my God. It's just.
If you were tasting it blind, what would you think?
I certainly would have gone Sauvignon Blanc. I thought it would have been an aged dry Sauternes from a warm vintage. I would go with a high-end, well-loved Sauternes white is where I probably would have gone with that.
It's like messes with it. Like Chenin Blanc came to mind.
Mm. Yes. Like a high-end Vouvray kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like it...
Yeah, I like your answer better. No, Vouvray. Yeah.
It was just like, it was on my most thrilling list as well, but because it's so like, because of the story, like the thrilling list is not necessarily the top wines. It's about, there's always a story, right? Ravine's sparkling wine, you know, was found in a, you know, somebody forgot about it in some warehouse somewhere that some other winemaker arranged 10 years later. They say, whoa, what the F is this?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know. Well, let's make a sparkling wine of it. And it's unbelievable.
But that helps because it's cool. You feel more of a connection to the wine and you're sipping it and you're thinking about the history of it. And that's going to elevate your enjoyment of it. Your enjoyment of the wine is not just about the phenolic characteristics. That's part of it, but it's really the whole tapestry of it that makes for your best wines. So we'll end with this. You were talking about the Wismar Wingfield Vineyard, and I'm gonna quote Rick Van Sickle from Rick Van Sickle's article. Well, it should be easy. It's you. You wrote this.
Okay.
Batchelder, not so quietly, refers to the Hill of Wingfield as one of his Grand Cru parcels, even though it is a classification that still has no standing in Niagara. And then in brackets, it says you write, but should. How important could that be to pushing's the wrong word, making people feel comfortable spending considerable amount of money? Like these wines are not cheap. You know, this is not your Tuesday wine. But if we started to recognize that certain vineyards do consistently produce great wines, and we tried our own version of Grand Cru, Premier Cru, how important do you think that would be for the Ontario wine industry?
I think it's pretentious as hell. But I'm all for it.
Of course. I mean, it. No, you're right. It is pretentious, but, you know, we grow to accept it in other parts of the world.
I know. And you know what? It's already happening. Like, we're you know, Thomas is pushing boundaries with it. I can tell you that there are little groups thinking about it, talking about it, figuring out... is there even a need to talk about it further? And that's how far that people have gotten talking about it.
And some are against it. I remember talking to JP Collat from 13th Street, and he waved off the idea. He's like, no, that's dumb.
Yeah. But there are still keeners out there. And, you know, Thomas now, if I pulled out a bottle, is there one here? That he's got the vineyard first, big letters, the sub-appellation in smaller letters.
Yep.
Tiny little band down there. It says Batchelder Wines.
I love it.
And now I'm seeing, just I was tasting at Collab, which, you know, fronts a bunch of different wineries, and a winery called Fogelaar, a great, great winemaker by the name of Mark Pister. Here, I'm gonna let you take that home from the Pocone Vineyard, which is Charles Baker's favorite vineyard.
Oh, is it? Wow.
You tell me about that Riesling. Anyway, he now is taking subapp and putting it up top.
Yeah.
Like Thomas, but not going all the way. And he
The font on the title of the winery is much, much smaller.
And he's going to, going forward, he's going to take Pocconi Vineyard, and it's going to be the Grand Cru, mm-hmm. and then the Sub App, and then little Fogelaar down below. So it's happening anyway.
Yeah.
Shouldn't there be rules? Shouldn't VQA, if people are going to do it, and it's a Wild West, anybody could do it. Some guy's got a quarter acre of 35 vines out there, and all of a sudden they're putting up their Al's Vineyard. Mm-hmm. But, no, there's got to be some weight behind doing that. No, or it's just...
No, I think there should be. I think classifications are important because I think it helps. I think it helps the people that are buying the wine. It's a great debate.
And 99% of the people don't care one bit.
No, I know.
But you're looking at that 1 to 5 percentile that are really into wine. Just like, you know, Burgundian nuts.
Yeah.
You know, they're looking for that.
But I'm trying to find the way to get the other 95% to find, get more joy and and experience more wines from this area.
Isn't that up to other wineries, isn't it?
It is. It is. But I like to fight the good fight because it's damn tasty. It's not, by the way, it's never out of patriotism. It's never out of, oh, I live here. It's more out of, I've tried all these wines. They're really good. The people that make them are really nice. They wake up early. They go to bed late. I'd like other people to try these wines as well. Rick, where can people find your work?
Winesinagra.com is the address.
It's a great website. It's you lay it out perfectly for people that are getting into wine, and it's simple, it's easy. The reviews are great. The work you put into it is impressive. The photos are fantastic as well. It's a testament. Like, you are definitely one of the more important people when it comes to helping to promote the wines of Niagara and Ontario wine, and I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing some damn good reason as well. Thanks so much, Rick.
You're too kind. Thank you very much, Matt, and I could say the same about you, and the podcasts you put together are raising the bar.
We'll end it there because, you know, we're going to get too... Canadians can't take too many compliments before we get uncomfortable.
No.
I really appreciate, Rick, and love having you back on for the second time. We will chat soon to get to all the other questions I had to. But right now, thanks everyone for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, iTunes, Apple, Spotify, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting!